leaven of the Pharisees. We're going to introduce lots of groups. This is one of the, we'll have long passages of scriptures that will just speak for themselves, but we'll introduce a few groups and let them, I think the passages are pretty self-evident what Jesus is saying. But we've got Pharisees to deal with, and you see those all through the scriptures. We've got Sadducees to deal with, and you'll see those in most of the Gospels, although they're not mentioned much in the Gospel of John, although they appear, but they hide under a different name. We're going to have scribes and have to distinguish those guys, and we're even going to have a little group called the Herodians. Now, one of the things we're going to see is that one of the message of Jesus is very consciously given in opposition to these people. I mean, you get the feeling that there was nothing good to say about them after a while, but that's not true. I mean, if you get a balanced picture from all the scriptures, it's not uniformly bad, but so often, just the very religion Jesus is trying to teach and propagate is stated in opposition to this. It's almost like, look at this and then look at Jesus. It's always match to one another. And he's got some long diatribes, actually, about these groups of people in the scriptures, especially in Matthew. Now remember, once again, one of our first lessons, Matthew chapter 9, we put Matthew's story in a chapter where there was a lot of healing that was needed and a lot of lostness was being corrected. Matthew did not consider himself one of the pious. I think he considered himself one of the broken and sinful. He was a tax collector, and he's pretty clear about that point. Well, these are guys that Matthew wasn't. And so I don't know how the Holy Spirit works with it in this case with Jesus with Matthew, but to, in a sense, he's got his eye on them, I think. Those were the people he was not. So maybe he was paying special attention when Jesus was addressing them, seeing that they had their problems too. So let's look at two passages. We'll just let them speak loudly for themselves. And the first one's in chapter 16, and it's 12 verses. And what I'll need is, I guess I'll need a narrator and a Jesus. Can I have a narrator to read the black type and a Jesus to read the red type for us, please?
Which verse?
We're in 16, 1 through 12. Okay, Bob, you got narrator or Jesus? You don't care. Let's give you the Jesus part. And can I get somebody to read the black type? Aaron, you got that? Thank you. 16, 1 through 12. Okay, there you have kind of a salvo. There have been others, actually. I mean, before this, we found in a previous chapter that Jesus addresses Pharisees, scribes, Sadducees. They all take their turn coming up and questioning them. In each case, he kind of, I don't want to say shoots them down, but settles the issue they're bringing, and we have that already. But this, again, then, is a major kind of assault on Sadducees and Pharisees. And there's not a lot of mystery in it. You get the feeling they're being kind of dopey, right? He says, beware the leaven of the Sadducees and Pharisees. They think it's about bread. And he straightens them out after a while. He figures out, look, bread is no problem in my ministry. I've got lots of bread, remember? But what is the leaven of the Pharisees?
Teaching.
Or you might have the word doctrine. And you might think that there could be some power in that as an image. I mean, how does leaven work?
It's real tiny.
Yeah.
Giant dough.
It doesn't take a lot necessarily to...
And it grows and it multiplies.
Precisely.
And it takes over the dough.
Right. It infests. I mean, it's insidious in its work, right? It starts with a little bit of stuff, and then it inflates a whole. Inflates is a great word. I mean, it creates little gas bubbles right out of nitrogen. Inflates a whole loaf.
It's exhausting.
Well, yeah, getting it back out without killing it's pretty hard. Very good point. So it is interesting that the leaven would be our image then for teaching. You get that horrible word doctrine that most modern Christians don't want to work on, but that's actually doctrine. If you have a King James Bible, that's what's going to be in there. It just means teaching, right? Now, the thing is, we've got, let's eliminate these guys for now. We've got Pharisees and Sadducees. And in order to say we're going to beware of their teaching, I think the very first thing you have to realize is the teaching of these two groups was very different. In other words, Jesus isn't, you can't say, well, let's find the common denominator between the Sadducees and Pharisees and eliminate it. In fact, their teaching was, and their whole approach to religion was different. But you might say then, what do they have in common if you're looking for it? Because we're to be aware of both of them. Well, what is it that they hold that would be true about both groups? Well, yeah, why? Now, contrast it with Matthew, for example. I mean, not the Gospel of Matthew. He said Matthew's planted his own story in chapter 9. He's an outsider, a sinner, a wounded person, a person in need of healing. That's how he sees himself. That's how he perceives himself. But Pharisees and Sadducees don't perceive themselves as tax collectors. They have nothing but contempt for people like Matthew. Proud. Yeah, the Sadducees in particular were known for pride and actually kind of a, you know, an arrogance, a coldness. These were tended to be aristocratic first families that were known for interrupting one another and being just harsh people in that regard. Well, I think that the issue here is these are religious people. In the worst and best sense of the word, these are religious sins we're looking at. They are the established religious figures of Jesus' world. And their approach to things is quite different, actually. But the thing they have in common is that if Jesus is addressing them, he's talking about these are the religious sins. I mean, there are all the other sins in the world, but everybody kind of knows they are sins. You know, they know that stealing and adultery and thievery, all that stuff's wrong. I mean, there's little to say about that in some ways. But religious sins are particularly insidious, like yeast. And why is that? Why are the sins of religious people so difficult to deal with? Well, because you develop them while you think you're serving God, right? I mean, you as you keep telling yourself you're right with God, I mean, you're pasting God's name on things. Actually, it's very interesting. Jesus spends more time, especially in the Gospel of Matthew, discussing the sins of the religious, the righteous, not in terms of, oh, you're hypocrites and you just do all this crass stuff, but actually their religious ideas are perverse and corrupting and hold people back from God. They're full of self-righteousness, for example. And these are particularly dangerous to people. I mean, you think about that. I mean, you can eliminate all the other sins in your life, but then you just get more and more proud while you do it, right? You begin to think, I'm pretty good at this. I'm a pretty righteous man. I'm pretty devout, aren't I? I thank God I'm not like other people, like this sinner over here, this tax collector. Look at him. You know, I fast twice a week. I give tenth of all I own. You know, you know these stories from the gospel, right? The religious person is uniquely perverse in the world of real faith because they keep thinking they're right. I mean, they're self-righteous, and that grows in people. I mean, I think when you think about that, we are the religious people, aren't we? I mean, we're the people who go to church, who sit in Sunday school, and, you know, heaven help me. I mean, I'm a scribe by all the scriptural definitions. I mean, we are particularly susceptible to the perversions of the religious imagination. And I always say this, remember that if we go back to the Garden of Eden, the first sin, in a sense, is a religious sin. It's not a sin about sex. It's not a sin about money. It's not a sin about, stealing your neighbor's car. What's it a sin of?
Doubt.
What's that?
Doubt.
Yeah, well, beyond doubt, just an absolute sin. We will be like gods. We will serve as our own authorities. There's a lie here. We can handle it ourselves religiously. We'll serve as our own gods. So you think the blast site of human depravity, ground zero of human depravity, is a religious choice. So you think religious sins are the worst, the most insidious of our sins, the most leavening of our sins. Adultery and theft are easily dismissed in that sense. I mean, they're blunt, they're open, most people know they're wrong, and nobody wallows in them. But religious sins infest us in a unique way, and we're the people who ought to be studying that, the Christians, right? I mean, it's very easy for us to look out at the world and say, oh, those party animals, they're just so full of uncleanliness and sin. But I think Jesus is always turning this around saying, your religion is full of sin, is how it looks. And that's brutal, right? So tell me about Pharisees. Anybody know anything intelligent about the Pharisees? Oh, yes. The Pharisees are a little group of lay people. They're never mentioned in the Old Testament. They appear in the New Testament time period. Nobody quite knows where they come from. But these were they had a strong emphasis on the law, and not just the law, but their interpretation of the Mosaic law. Now, a lot of people think this springs from the time of the exile. The temple's been shut down. They're in a foreign country, and you need some organizing principle for religious life. So you base it on the study of the law. Vicki, if you're going to get me a drink, don't bother. I've got one, and that's what I'm choking on. It would just be pouring gas on the fire here. Thank you anyway. Well, anyway, you don't have a temple with priests and sacrifice and all that apparatus of religion that existed in Jerusalem. It's all been ripped down by the Babylonians. You're stuck over in this other country. So what do? Well, you want to keep your religion alive. They began to study the law, and a lot of stuff comes out of that time period that's not mentioned in the Old Testament. It just sort of appears in the New Testament. The synagogue, for example, they don't exist in the Old Testament. They exist in the New Testament. Most synagogues, or at least most of the ones we know of, were Pharisaic synagogues. They were run by the Pharisees. The role of the rabbi. The rabbi doesn't exist in the Old Testament so much. He exists in the New Testament. They were probably mostly somehow connected to the Pharisees and to the synagogue. But the practice of Pharisaic religion was around the study of the law in a synagogue under a rabbi. I mean, those kind of things all walk hand in hand, and you don't really see a trace of them anywhere in the Old Testament. You only see them in the New Testament. But they were the hyper-righteous, the ones with the extra rules. You know, give them 10 commandments, they're looking for number 11. And they regarded themselves very highly, and they did impress people on one level for their righteousness. At the same time, they annoyed people. You know how that would work. I mean, people who are super righteous are both impressive and annoying, right? It just depends on how well you feel you identify with them on a given day. But that's the world of the Pharisees. Synagogues, rabbis, study of the law, extra commandments to make sure you were among the elite of the religious forces. You held the rest of the religious world somewhat in contempt. They're the weaklings. I hate to say this, but I mean, like, if you look in the history of the church, I mean, who are the Pharisees? And you think, well, they're like the Green Berets, right? I mean, they're the special forces. And I hate to say it, but the Mennonites were among the people with Pharisaic tendencies, right? I mean, just, we do all things. We'll do them harder. We'll do them better. That kind of rigorism characterized them. You know, those Methodists, they're just a little too loose, you know? I mean, we need, you know, we'll take it all literally and apply it more firmly. Don't mean to trample on anyone. We've all got a bit of the inner Pharisee in us. I just think we need to beat him up and slap him around a lot. That's my view. So who are the Sadducees? Yeah, the one thing we know from them biblically is from a doctrinal level, they didn't have time for all the cosmic junk as they thought it. There's no afterlife necessarily, and there's no angel or anything like that. They were all about kind of a material religion right here on earth, and they had their reasons for that.
Were they more connected with like the political era and so forth?
They could be, partly because they were rich. And they had more vested interests in the status quo than the others did. So, the Sadducees are connected to the priesthood. Zadok the priest. You know, you'll hear that name, and maybe that name comes from it. These are the people who are around the temple, and they're about a religion of sacrifices and priestly power and coming to Jerusalem. That's one of the reasons they drop out of the New Testament. is because the temple gets destroyed, right, in about 70 AD, and the Sadducees are out of a job. There is a place in Acts where it says many priests come to the Lord, and it's a good thing. I mean, they are unemployed when the temple goes down. They were unemployed during the exile when the synagogue arose and the Pharisees and rabbis became the star of the show. I mean, what are you going to do with a priest? You know, he doesn't got a temple to work at. He doesn't have a sacrificial system intact. They don't have that level of organization. But if this is the hardcore, institutionalized, organized religion, and these priests were the elitists in it, and they were powerful people who had political power. I mean, they were the ones, they were the establishment. This was the man, the suit. You might call it the robe. Yeah, they were powerful people, and their contempt for other people was enormous. So you get that difference? I mean, so when Jesus says, beware the leaven of the scribes and Pharisees, I mean, you'd have to be, if you were one of the people originally hearing this, going, well, good heavens, what's the common ground between the two of them? Because actually, although they would cooperate with one another every once in a while, actually, they couldn't stand each other. So it'd be like Jesus saying, beware the leaven of the Democrats and the Republicans. Say, well, wait a second. I mean, if it's teaching, then exactly what is the leaven here, since they apparently teach different things and don't even really like each other for the most part. What else did I tell you? Well, here I'd say in both cases, though, these are the religious paths that have been mapped out with a lot of human energy and a lot of self-justification and self-righteousness. And Jesus says, beware of this. The Pharisees were all about rigorism and legalism. They were judgmental. If you were all about rigorism, that's that pumped up religion, if you give me 10 commandments, I'll do 11. What sin do you suppose it's particularly susceptible to? Or sins?
Pride.
What?
Pride
would be high on the list. And what else then?
Contempt.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, pride and contempt are like walking hand in hand.
Hypocrisy.
Well, that's don't back off. Just stop there. Hypocrisy. Well, of course. I mean, I think we're like Rob's sermon. I mean, we recognize, of course, that we're not that righteous. I mean, we can hold ourselves to high or even beautiful standards, but we recognize that we fail pretty regularly at it. But the Pharisees apparently didn't have much sense of themselves as hypocrites. They thought of themselves as being consistent. And we're about to see that, in fact, what Jesus is going to do in chapter 23 is, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! He'll say it 8 times to them in the passage. Well, 7, depending on your translation. He'll say that to him 7. What do you suppose if you were a Sadducee would be if you had that kind of ritualized, priestly, temple, establishment religion, what sin would you fall into? I mean, it would be hypocrisy too. We'll cover them both with that, but
complacency.
Perhaps. It's easy to be complacent when you're on top, right? You're always a defender of the status quo when you're on top. Yeah, oh, big time. Actually, both groups had problems with this one. Well, I think a cold superiority and a formalized religion, a religion of ritual but not content, a religion that was not personal, I think infected them. Well, let's turn to Matthew 23, because we're going to get more content here. On your way, you wanted to stop at 22. Remember, I told you each group, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the scribes, all come at him at different points, and he responds to them. But we're going to get a long list of woes to the scribes and Pharisees here. Let's we're going to drop the Sadducees out and add the scribes. I said I was a scribe. What's a scribe, do you think? What's a scribe? When we get to 23, we're going to drop the Sadducees out of the list. Jesus is going to really work on Pharisees and scribes, hypocrites. I'm sorry, I said Sadducees earlier, but woe to you, Pharisees and scribes, hypocrites. Scholars. Yeah, the scribes start out being kind of the... they're considered the last bastion holding on to orthodoxy. They're the ones who make the law a study of life, and they work on it. And so they were regarded as kind of guardians or custodians. This starts out really well in the book of Ezra in the Old Testament, where you see Ezra is a scribe. But it comes down to like a bad lawyer joke. Excuse me, Jack. I mean, by the time you get to Jesus' time, I mean, they are considered people who can bend it to their own interests, right? And so in a sense, they're the Pharisees and scribes are not the same groups. They you can't identify them exactly with one another. Although I'm told that most scribes were probably also Pharisees, but scribes were people who made a practice of the study of the law. Now remember, the law has a couple of dimensions in the Jewish world. I mean, it's got the religious law, the kind of theology. So they'd be part theologian, but in part they'd be part, like Jack, they'd be talking about like civil and criminal law, because all that law was a part of the law too. So I mean, there were dimensions of the law that would be comprehensive, both about religious truths and about, like, I don't know, like keeping order in society, punishing malfeasance. Such a great word. Anyway, let's look at 23. Now I need to... The narrator only has one line, so I'll take it. And I'd like us to read 23. Let's read 1 through 12 first and pause, because this is a different phase of the teaching. So who will read Jesus for me here, down through verse 12? Got it, Andrea? Thank you. And I'll start with the narration. So, then Jesus spoke to the multitudes and to his disciples, saying,
"The teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in..."
Okay. First of all, who are we speaking to here? The big crowds and disciples, right? So this is not. Now, he's going to turn rather abruptly in chapter 13 and begin to discuss the Pharisees and scribes. I mean, his attention will turn to a direct address to them. Now, whether they're standing there and he's pointing at them, I don't know. I mean, or maybe he's just doing it for the crowd. But in a sense, for right now, these first 12 verses, he's addressing the crowd about them. And in verse 3, I think we get a lesson a little bit in interpretation and say, how would you interpret verse 3? Yeah, do what they say, not what I do. Classic kind of, fatherhood's advice, right? Do as I say, not as I do. I don't think you want to over-interpret this verse, because clearly he doesn't like what they do either. I mean, if you get real literalistic in your interpretation, I think you can miss the point entirely. I don't think he's saying, like, be like them or do everything they tell you, because there are too many other places in the scriptures where he says, don't be like them and don't do what they tell you. I mean, you get that really clearly. But I think he's saying, take the spirit of what they're saying, take the best of what they are or imagine themselves to be. There's no problem with that. The problem is they don't live up to their own picture of themselves at their best. I mean, I'd watch out. In Bible interpretation, this might be really a good verse to contemplate a little bit, to think you could overinterpret that and perhaps suggest that Jesus is telling his disciples just to be Pharisees only better. I don't think that's what he's saying to them. They bind heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on men's shoulders. How do they do this? Oh, yeah. The Sabbath laws were outrageous. I mean, it was, I think it's 630 or something like that, commandments the Pharisees had figured out were applying. And a lot of those were Sabbath kinds of things that were just kind of, some of them got even humorous. They think in the Gospel of John, for example, that he might have been deliberately flaunting them in the one case in John 9 where he heals the blind man, where he spits into the clay, and that the Pharisees would have considered this plowing, because it, you know, separated and then kneads it, and women weren't allowed to knead bread. So, I mean, some people think, interpret this as if he's like, hey, look at this, guys, you know, and then just like, you know, doing deliberately the things that would irk them. But clearly he sees it as a man-made layer in religion. Now, we think about the verses we had. We've already studied Matthew 11. He said, my yoke is light, you know, take it on, it's easy. And now he's saying these people tie up heavy burdens. Do you think the church ever does this to people? Well, it's so easy when you're in religious mode to give obligation to people. And, you know, and I don't think it's always wrong, but at the same time, it can get heavy and oppressive on people. And if it blocks somebody's kind of free access or understanding of themselves before God as a person loved, for example, who has to work out things on their own time, it's very easy for religious ideas to knuckle people under. Tell me about verse 5. What do they make broad?
People to see.
What do they make broad for people to see?
Phylactery.
A phylactery. What is a phylactery?
It's like as a box with the scriptures in that tie on the forehead.
Yeah. It's like crossing yourself. I never know which way to go. They tie it to the right arm or to the left arm. Have you ever seen an Orthodox Jew pray? You know, they have a tallis, a prayer towel, shawl. Very good. That's where I was looking for. And they'll have fringes on it. And they'll tie a phylactery on it. It's like a box. It has the law in it, the commandments, right? Just to bind them on your forehead. Remember how that goes from Deuteronomy 6, is it? When you teach the ways of the Lord, bind them onto your hands. Literally. And so you know, they have a little ribbon thing. They tie it around their forehead, and it sits there. And of course, they'll sway and pray with their towel around, their shawl around them, and do that. You ever seen that, like in a movie or anything? I've seen it done. You know, I've got visit synagogues, so I've seen this kind of thing. It's fascinating. So if you're broadening your phylactery, what would you be doing? Yeah, why would you do that? Lots of law. Now, say maybe they just have poor vision or something like that. I don't know that you get that out of it. But the idea is that it's a show of religion. Now, I don't know. I mean, I understand there's some of that. What else do they do? They broaden their phylacteries. Enlarge the borders. That doesn't make sense. What exactly are we referring to here? Well, the Jewish, remember the prayer shawl has tassels on it. Why did it have tassels on it? This actually, once again, comes from the law to remind you of the commandments. Now, so you could get real fanciful about that. I don't think in the law, when you get back to the Old Testament law, where they have tassels on their garments to remind themselves of their commandments, which I think comes from Deuteronomy. I didn't look it up again. How many tassels do you have? But actually, back in these days when the rabbis were beginning to get very specific about their religious content, they actually had arguments about how long those tassels should be. So the house of Shammai, you know, the Rabbi Shammai wanted a longer tassel. Hillel, you could have a little shorter tassel. Generally speaking, if you were a Jew at this time period, I think you'd want to follow Hillel and not Shammai. Shammai was the sourpuss, the Dutch uncle, the really rigorous Pharisee. Hillel was a little more generous and grandfatherly and interesting. But these two rabbis, just before the time of Jesus, their disciples would always argue with one another. And one of their arguments, of course, is how long should the tassels be? But we can say all this only comes from a religious mind that's gone perverse. It's missing the point entirely, and it's all about show and display. And that's what we see here. They love the best places feast, the best places in synagogues, greetings in the marketplace. And then he says in 8, 9, and 10, don't be called father, don't be called teacher, don't be called what? What is it? Master. Yeah, it's probably rabbi, isn't it? Or isn't it? What do they say? Do they have a footnote on you for that? I have teachers, rabbi, or no, I have, let's see. Let's get clear here. You're in verse 7, Keith? Okay, and that's where it says teacher for me. You have masters there? Well, what do you think? Should we do that or not do that? What's that called, by the way, in language when you have titles like that? So, like if you're like in the church, what's the minister called? Reverend. What's a right reverend? Yeah, what's a most right reverend? Yeah, what's a canon? I like that one. I always wanted to be a canon.
A loose cannon?
What's that?
A loose cannon?
Yeah, well, I ended up being one, but in a different sense than was the code. Well, reverend's just your average ordinary minister, but he's a reverend. And a right reverend's a bishop. I don't know what a most right reverend is. Archbishop, so he has control over other bishops. A canon, as I understand, a canon was a guy who works directly for the bishop or archbishop of a diocese. He doesn't have necessarily duties in a congregation. He's sort of like the CIA of the bishop, you know. I mean, he's kind of the operative, you know, who can work for it. We get all this kind of stuff going. Now, Mennonites have never gone for that, but they've still, what do they call their pastors? What's that? Oh, pastor. I got the brother treatment a lot of times when I was in the South, but, you know, somehow when people called me brother, I was annoyed. You know, I just thought, I'm sorry, I mean, you're saying brother, but in fact you're actually separating me from you because you don't greet everybody in the church that way, but when Brother Reuben speaks. You know, once I did a funeral, and they refused to leave this stuff out about me officiating at the funeral. You know, there's a guy there at the funeral home saying, how do you want the bishop, are you called reverend? I said, no, our denomination doesn't use that term. So what are you? Should I call you Pastor Reuben? So I said, you can say I am the pastor, but you don't have to use it as a title. He refused to do it. I think I ended up reverend in the Mobile Register. You know, that just wouldn't do it. Well, you know, father, of course, if you're a Catholic, you'll call the priest father, right? If you're an Anglican, you might call him father. The Anglicans, when I became a Christian, wouldn't do that. But I was always startled when they called their minister. So should we do all that stuff? This is all called honorifics. Honorifics. Every culture and society has them. It seems like Jesus is kind of saying, don't do that. The Quakers, who were with the Mennonites and not using any honorifics, had real problems with this because they had to make a pitch to King George, but they couldn't call him King or Your Highness or Your Excellency or anything like that without violating their religion. So the Quakers, as I understand it, had the nerve to come into the royal court and say, friend George, will you hear our petition? What do you think? Should we practice this literally, or is it just embrace the spirit of this teaching? This would be like, if we were to practice it literally, we would just be being like the Sadducees and Pharisees lengthening the tassels of our garments. I think that's the heart of it, certainly. So that if you could use the titles and still have that perspective, or not use them and still have that perspective anyway. As I said, it used to annoy me sometimes when I got called brother because it was clearly doing that to me. It was putting me in a different category. Well, here's my guess. We should practice it literally. I just can't believe it. I think it's very hard to eliminate honorifics from language, but I think in a sense consciously we should work towards not using honorific titles, and don't feel obligated to use one to me. If you, friend. I don't know, it puts me in an awkward situation. I've been introduced, you know, to Catholic priests. This is Father Joe. Hi. I've been in sticky situations. I've succumbed to it, you know. I mean, because it didn't seem like there was any polite way out of it. It seems like being impolite would certainly not be Jesus' intention. I think if we're going to do it, we should go for more elaborate ones. My associate pastor, who is a radical Baptist and really liked this kind of stuff too, eliminating honorifics. So we found, we were in a Catholic cathedral in Mobile, and we found two titles on the grave plaques in the wall, and one was, he adopted one and I adopted the other. So he was His Holiness and Beatitude, Reverend David Garner, but he had to refer to me as Egregious Doctor. So but we only did that back and forth to each other. You know, we didn't ask the congregation to address us by those titles. His Holiness and Beatitude. I like that one. Yeah, and that's another one to wonder about. Because they say, give honor to whom honor is due. Paul, when he addresses Felix, most excellent Felix, he says, you know. So, I mean, I don't want to overinterpret it. I think you're probably right. I think it's probably more for the brotherhood, sisterhood, the church, where we should try to eliminate honorific titles, at least in as much as they seem to create different tracts. Well, without missing the whole thing here, as I said, these speak for themselves. Let's read, starting in verse 13, down through verse 29, and we'll be cutting off the chapter there. But would anybody like to read this to us? I mean, these are his, some of you will have a verse in here others don't have. The depends on your translation, and so you would add it up to either seven woes if you don't have that verse, or eight woes if you do. I think it's 14, the one that might disappear on somebody. But would somebody woe us through this, please? 13 through 29. Ryan's got it.
These are the righteous.
Yeah, okay. Let's just charge down through there and look at a couple of different things. First of all, verse 14 was missing, so we had seven woes. If you have a King James, you'll have verse 14. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers. Therefore, you will receive greater condemnation. Woe is an expression you're probably familiar with. It has a couple of things. Woe, the expression of pain and suffering on your part, woe is me. But woe is also a condemnatory phrase. Woe to you. Watch out. Bad things are happening that you get there. We get a long set of passages about the swearing of oaths. It gets really complicated here, and this shows the mind and reasoning of the Pharisees, really, that they went so far in their details of the law that they had different ideas about what you could swear by or not swear by in the temple and the altar and things like that. So it's basically saying, you're missing the point. The swearing is not connected to whether it's the gold or the altar or any of the kind. It's what you're who you're addressing in heaven that matters. I hope you heard it many times. You for many people, verse 24, I'm glad you laughed. My guess is that when Jesus first said this, he cracked everybody up. You strain out a gnat, you swallow a camel. The words are very similar in Aramaic. They would have had a nice little rhyming kind of scheme when Jesus said it in the original languages. The outside of the cup, actually, there's some more literally true there than you want. And, of course, the whitewashed tombs. Now, the interesting thing about the whitewashed tombs was that they whitewashed them not to make them beautiful, but to signal them. When people came into the town for religious festivals, they whitewashed the tombs so that you wouldn't go near them and defile yourself during the festival. I mean, obviously, whitewash is not a beautiful paint job. There were elaborate decorated tombs, and you can still see the remnants of some of them. Herod had one of the all-time greats, as I understand it, over there at that time. But those would be the kinds of things you'll see. But all of that, I think, could miss the point for us in a sense. I mean, the idea is that Jesus was warning them away from religion gone mad, religion with the human element, a religion that had grown perverse in its reasoning. And Jesus spends a lot of time trying to sort that out for people. We need to quit. So let me get you to stand, and we'll finish again with the Great Commission from the end of Matthew. Remember, if you have children, you'll need to go collect them. Jesus, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go, therefore, make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things that I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. Amen. Thanks.